Okay.
This guy's working. He's earning his money.
In five, four, three, two, and rock and roll.
Pam, I think you've lived in this house all your life, and that being the case, I assume you grew up here, and you've known all these families that were involved in the great names that the American public knows today as Quaker State and Pennzoil and what have you. What was it like just being around these people as a young girl growing up?
Well, actually, we never thought it was anything different than what we knew, because that's all we knew. I mean, our families took us on vacations and things like that, but basically, your friends' parents were your father's business cohorts. Mm-hmm. And one thing, I mean, I'm here, and so I'm getting interviewed, but so many of my friends that I've moved away were all part of this. We just didn't know anything really different. And my girl, my best friend, Susie Klinger, lived right down the street at 519 West 3rd, and Old McDay O'Day House.
Yeah.
And her dad and my dad graduated from high school together. And he went to Lehigh, my dad went to Cornell. They came back and they got jobs with Quaker State and Mr. Klinger, Art Klinger, with Pennzoil. And then they eventually both became in their respective companies. I'm not doing this well at all.
Okay. Why don't we start this again?
Start all over.
Yeah, start all over again.
I'll get going. That's, you're doing
well, that's okay, because actually I liked the shot that I have now. One quick note too. This is a kind of a weird acting thing, but when we look at people, we choose an eye to look at usually. Choose Neil's outside eye.
Okay.
Because that'll open your face up to the camera just a little bit more.
Okay.
You guys are doing great. Just ignore us, ignore the cameras, and rock and roll.
Give us a 5-4-3.
And 5-4-3. And
Pam, you've lived in this wonderful house all your life. And that leads to the natural question. What was it like growing up here as a young girl and then maturing with all of these families that were associated with these famous, nationally known companies? Just what was it like?
Well, it was nothing unusual because it was all that I knew. And certainly we had vacations. We went places, but our lives were here. We had relatives out of town. It was just the normal thing. My girlfriend, Susie Klinger, her dad was purchasing agent at Pennzoil at the same time that my dad was purchasing agent at Quaker State when they were starting out in their careers. In fact, he founded the department at Quaker State. And they were just good friends, and they went to the same conventions, and I went to lots of times. Atlantic City, Ethel Corporation would have a big party in the fall at the Traymore, and we were all there, and you just were together, and the men went off on the train, the sleeper train, to Washington during the war to get priorities for steel and things they had to go to get for the war purposes of the refineries. Mm-hmm. And some of our friends, we augmented our friends by going from Innisfree School, then to Southside Junior High, and then to Senior High. But basically, our friends were our neighbors. And I was in every house in this whole neighborhood, and I was upstairs and downstairs and in their basements and in their attics, and we called everybody Aunt Libby or Uncle Art, and that's the way it was.
It was life. Well, for the benefit...
Safe and calm.
Oh, yes, yeah, all right. This was the best of America at its time. It's a time that's since changed somewhat. You were mentioning how good the schools were and good the teachers were, and you consider yourself fortunate to be part of that public school system that they had in this.
We had a wonderful school system, and in fact, on a Christmas card just like this year from a classmate named Fred Quinn, who is now in Salt Lake, but he's moving back to Washington, and he has written a lot of books, and Miss Reed had all of his books, and they're all now donated to the library, and he was a senior State Department official, and he wrote about his wonderful teachers and all of his wonderful life, and we were sort of at the end of an era. Mm-hmm. growing up, of the good life in this town.
Uh-huh. And you mentioned Miss Reed, that'd be Margaret Reed.
Margaret Reed and Burl Eddy and Mrs. Dwink, a woman who was head of the math department in those days. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And they were very educated people.
Well, I had the privilege of meeting Margaret Reed before she passed away. She was an impressive woman, and she would be impressive and great anywhere, and she certainly was. And if she's an indication of the quality of teachers you had, you were fortunate, Pam.
Well, we had another one, Miss Lida, Henrietta Lida. She never gave a multiple choice test.
All right.
You had to write essays, and it was like a professor I had at college. If you gave an answer and you said the people, and she would say, the people, who are the people, who are you talking about? You had to be so definite, and that's the way that Miss Lida was.
Now that's a really interesting point to me, because as you know, I came up here from Pittsburgh, and one of the things I noticed when I arrived here is how verbal the whole town was. These people, it's like going to England. When you go to England, you learn that there's another group of people, they speak the language very well, they just have a mastery of it that we don't typically have in America. That might be why so many people up here are so well-spoken, so verbal, and I might also add why they all want to grab the mic when they're on stage. Have you ever noticed that?
No. Not I.
Okay.
Not I.
But it comes from those kinds of teachers, and you were fortunate, quite fortunate.
We were, and I didn't know what I wanted to do in college, and I didn't even know where I wanted to go, but Miss Reed and Miss Eddy had both gone to my college.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know. They both go
together. Yeah.
Right. Is that why you chose to go?
No, I went in a way because right down on Willow Street were the Daly family, and they had three girls and a boy. The boy was my class. The three girls were my babysitters. They were older, and they all three went there.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh.
And my mother had a friend who was a professor from here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Dorothy Shields.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you and I both could see. Good school, wouldn't you say?
It's different.
Even though our friends from Clarion are going, oh, well, yes, but good school, got you.
Well, I was lucky because I never even saw the place until I was dumped there.
Mm-hmm.
I never went to see it. I wanted to be in Oil City. Mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking ahead.
Well, it worked out.
Yeah, yeah.
And you ended up, you're telling us before, you ended up a fine arts major, which is your real love and passion. You still carry that with you today.
Oh, nobody can take that away from me.
No.
And then the other thing was I got talked into taking a physiology class and then anatomy, and nobody can take that away from me. Mm-hmm. But that isn't the oil business.
No. Let's get back a little bit to the oil business. After all, that did make this street, it made this Southside neighborhood, it made Oil City, it's made this region. And let's just expand a little bit, again, about the neighborhood to our right, I suppose it would be to the viewer's left here, the old Berry house, and one of the Berry sons lived there. And then there was another Berry the other way, and then Charles Soar was down the way. These names are famous names, known throughout the country, not just in this region. What was it like living beside these kind of Berries?
This was Charlie Berry over here, and he was married first to a Splane, and Mr. Splane built that house for them for a wedding gift, and then they had two girls, and then she died. And then he married Carlotta Smithman, and Mr. Charlie Berry had to buy that house back from his ex-father-in-law.
Yes.
And they were away all summer. They had a big home over at Conneaut Lake, but they were wonderful neighbors. They had, Carlotta had two children to Mr. Berry, and then then Betty Berry Breen was married in this house to Sam Breen, mm-hmm. and they were very nice people. They had a very fancy house,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
it's probably the best house in the block. I know
mm-hmm.
it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a wonderful garage, and they have a heated garage, and the chauffeur sat up there in his room, and he had a bathroom. And this house on the other side of us was built by the Boyle family.
Yes.
And, in fact, in the garage in that house, on the ceiling, are all old plates from Derrick's.
Just to bring our audience up to date real quick now, the Berries you associate with Quaker State, the Boyle family you associate with the Derrick, the Oil
yes.
City Derrick, which in its time was, in the oil communities throughout the country, was recognized as the leading paper in the country in its time. So folks should be aware of that. And you had those two neighbors.
Well, this is Charlie Berry, and Jim Berry, James lived down on Callan Third, and they were the sons of the founder of the company called James B. Berry and Sons, mm-hmm. which became part of Quaker State when all the corporations merged to make Quaker State. Mm-hmm. So they continued to be a more import-export business because mm-hmm. When I was young, the companies that for Quaker State they had an office in London and in Holland, and they were named James B. Berry.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
those men used to come over here, and we went over there.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Yeah.
Now, we want to, of course, touch on your father. Let's introduce your father as a subject, and we'll say a little bit, and then we'll go back to some of your earlier family ties, and then I really think we should come back to your dad possibly a little later on. But your father ultimately, Lee Forker, ultimately became the president chief executive officer of Quaker State after a long career. And you were telling me earlier he actually grew up here in Oil City. Am I correct on that?
He was born on West 2nd near Central,
uh-huh.
as were his two brothers.
Uh-huh.
He was the middle of three boys.
And he ends up going to Cornell.
As all did the other two boys, too.
How'd they get there? What was the...
My grandfather Forker had a friend who he admired a great deal, and he had gone to Cornell. And at the time that my dad and my Uncle Ben and my Uncle Truby were there, and they lived at 620 West 1st, there were something like 18 boys at Cornell at the same time,
mm-hmm.
in about two blocks.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah.
Quite a representation.
No women.
No women. Exactly.
No,
there shouldn't have been any women. They should have never admitted to women.
Oh, he felt that way.
Yeah, good for him.
He didn't date co-eds.
Is that right?
Of course, I screamed at him.
Yeah, right. Well, that was a distraction. And okay, now, your whole family, we go back and back and back. All of your grandparents had something to do with the early oil industry.
They did.
And let's go back. Let's go back to what I call the beginning of your family's role in this area. And I'm going to pick one. Let's just start with the Robinson family down there, Ron Parker. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Okay. My grandmother Forker was Olive Gilpin Robinson, the youngest girl and the next to the youngest of like 13 children growing up in Parker. And my great-grandfather, Elisha I Robinson,
mm-hmm.
was a farmer and a tanner, because there was a lot of hemlock down there, and they had a big farm and a big family, and they then discovered oil. Hmm. And in fact, later I would like to show the picture I have of the chapel.
Mm-hmm.
The Lord was good to him, and he was kind of like a would-be wannabe Methodist minister or something, and he built a chapel, cut stone. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And different people in our family have been married there. And we all would walk in like the landed gentry sometimes, you know. But I go down there and take my friends. I'll take you. I mean, it's nice. So they had a big family, and they had, so these were aunts and uncles of my dad's. And, you know, I knew them. We went down and made cider and got apples and Parker, and they lived other places. He married a woman named Carolyn Truby. We married twice into the Truby family. And some of her relatives, well, it was Colonel Christopher Truby, how I went into DAR. He was with Matt Anthony Wayne. He was a fighter who somehow got to Westmoreland County when it was very large, and they founded the town of Greensburg.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Ah. And there are things down in that art museum there that are from our family.
Yeah, the Greensburg Art Museum. Yes,
it's good.
Yes,
good.
It is. That's worth the trip.
So anyhow, we've got the Robinsons, and then the Trubys, and I won't go into that. So what else?
Well, let's just dwell just a moment more on the Robinson family. A lot of the audience won't appreciate the fact that some of those early wells around Parker were drilled on the Robinson farm or very close by. There's a lot of references to the Robinsons in your early oil history around Parker. And I'm just going to fill them in here real quick, Pam, but when the movement of oil production left Venango County and Warren County, the southern part of Warren County, it went down to around where the Robinson family had located. So they played an early role in the development of the Armstrong and Butler and Clarion County
fields. Those counties all come together there, yeah.
Right there at that point. And, of course, also there was the big exchange at Parker, which was the early real big exchange. We can mention the Titusville ones in Oil City a little later, but that family was involved. Now, let's make a shift here. How about going up to Titiute? Let's go in the other direction. We'll go all the way up to Titiute, where another one of your great-grandfathers, I believe, Captain John Tonkin, came up to Titiute after the Civil War. He was a Confederate officer, of all things, and he came to Titiute. Tell us how that happened.
Okay, as a little boy, they came from England to Duck, Tennessee, because they were his father was a mine foreman or something, and part of it was tin and part of it was copper. And they came over, and then the war came, and he was in college, and the college closed. And then they all, if they could get a gun and a horse, they could be an officer, I guess. And so he ended up being, at the end, a bodyguard to Jefferson Davis. And he was captured at Vicksburg, and they returned the officers, northern for southern, so he didn't have to sit in a prisoner camp. But he then, when they surrendered, he got arrested again, and then he was let go. And his father got a message to him with some money to not to come down there, because the carpetbaggers were already there, and he gave him the name of a friend of his father's friend in New York and in eastern Pennsylvania. So he went to the coal mines, and then he heard about the oil days here, and so he got up here. But when he got to Titiute, he was not welcomed by any of the women.
I often wondered, yes.
Yes, because their brothers and their sons and everybody were being killed and hurt by the Southerners. And so he did business in their offices. He did business in the street, but he never was invited to a home. But then he met who became my great-grandmother, Margaret Ferguson, then Tonkin, because she was from St. Louis, which was neutral. And she had two little boys, and she was a widow. Uh-huh. And she came up to help her sister run a boarding house, because what else was she going to do? Uh-huh. So they sparked, and they got married, and they had a pile of kids, uh-huh. of which my Grandma Egbert was the oldest, Frances.
Well, all right. So he worked, I believe he was a manager of various refining operations.
Well, he was mostly with Rockefeller. Yeah, and they sent him to gas field, to work in the gas area of Ohio. Mm-hmm. And then they came back here at some point and lived in Oil City.
Yeah. Again, we'll fill in our audience a little bit. He did work for natural gas interests of the National Transit Company. That's all Standard Oil mm-hmm. at the time. And they did move, as you say, this other end of 3rd Street into the big house that Dr. Deschamps currently lives.
We call the Ramage House. Yeah.
The Ramage House. There
Petroleum and West 3rd. Yeah. They had a lot of kids.
Yes.
These people had big families.
These were all handsome, good-looking guys and good-looking women. What do you think, Pam? They managed to have children. You've always, I've talked to you before about Captain Tonkin, and I've always got the impression that you kind of like him or the stories you hear about him.
Well,
you
never saw any of these people, but I did, I talked to a lot of my cousins. I wanted to know, who has a picture of him as a young man or in a military uniform or something? Nobody does.
Well, is that right? You sure you haven't come across at least one?
No, there's maybe a West Virginia relative that I have to work on, because he's got his sword and his uniforms and stuff, but I don't know about a young photograph.
Oh, okay, well, we'll look for one. We'll have to remember that. Now, we may as well point out, at least for our local audience, that his son married a young woman from Oil City, T.P. Simpson's daughter.
Right.
And then...
That was Uncle Jack Tonkin.
Mm-hmm. And that the house that we all know now is the Hutchinson Funeral House. It's also known in this area as the Anderton House, the Anderton family house.
I think the Andertons bought it from Uncle Jack.
Yeah, I think
so. Or Mr. Simpson, yeah.
So that's where they lived. So.
Right.
All right.
That was a wedding present also.
Yeah.
And they lived in it a very short time, because he went to Pittsburgh for business.
Yeah. So
her name was May Simpson.
May Simpson.
Tonker.
Right. Yeah. She had one of the grandest weddings Oil City ever recorded.
Oh, I don't know, the Morks might not say
that. Oh, the Morks might not agree with that. Well,
she tore down a house next door to
her wedding. But think about it, she tore down the Geary house.
Yep.
There may have been more reasons than just to have a wedding, but she tore that one down. The Gearys happen to be, believe it or not, they happen to be the extended family. I happen to know some of them before I came up here, so they, their angle there was torn down for other reasons.
Well,
just tell you that. All right, let's go to another line, if you will. The Egbert. Of course, you're known also as an Egbert descendant. And your great-grandfather, and that was Dr. Milton Egbert. And you were telling us before we started the interview, and I've known this for a while, those three brothers were all physicians, correct? And they came from?
Mercer County, and they were a big family, too. And their father, I mean, they named these kids. I mean, Milton Cooper Egbert and Albert Gallatin Egbert. Thaddeus was the one who remained a doctor. The other two were very early into the oil days and stayed in.
Mm-hmm.
And as I told you before, they were there very, very early. In fact, there's a book I want to show you that how early they were drilling. And they were ended up with Petroleum Center as sort of their headquarters for a lot of years. And they owned, really, the town. I mean, they had leases on these things that they could tear down a house at 6 weeks' notice or something like that. Of course,
mm-hmm.
it was a horrible town.
Mm-hmm.
It was rough, tough,
mm-hmm.
and dirty.
But that's the way it was. In the we're talking now in the early 1860s, in the 1862, 63, 65, that period there. The Egbert and Hyde Farm was a very productive farm in 63, 64, 65. And I will again educate the audience here a little quick. At the time they were producing, it was a big producing farm. Oil was worth a lot of money, so they did pretty well in those years.
They did, and they spent it too.
And tell us a little. Dr. Milton Egbert actually built a fine family residence out there in that area on that road that goes up to.
It's up almost to the tree line.
Yes.
It was, and there's a picture of it in the office at the state park building, and a picture of them, which I put in. And they had a little wall around their house and a little fence around their house, trying to keep, I guess, the riffraff away. I don't know, but it couldn't have been easy living, especially for a woman.
Yeah.
But they seem to struggle, and as I told you before, they were gamblers. I mean, they had it, and they didn't have it, and they had it, and when they had it, they went off on a grand tour to Europe.
Yeah.
And they bought stuff. That table, silver, the silver that they bought, the same pattern for every woman in their family, married, unmarried, and on the back of the top of it, it was monogrammed, very scrolly. You almost have to get out a jeweler's loop and look to see whose it is. And I just got it augmented and gave it to my nephew for his wedding present.
Is that right?
Yeah, I don't have any to show you. And I had to buy more. And I was in Paris for 10 days with an old Denver roommate, and we lived down the street from this Madeleine Hotel. It's a big classic column church that Napoleon stopped and started building, and I'd never been in it, and you have a big circle street around it. And I looked up and I said, you know, Wendy, we're going to leave here, and I've never been in that place. Let's go up. So we walked up about a half a block from the hotel, and we went in, and it was dusk, so you couldn't see the stained glass. You know, it was kind of a bummer. It had a wrought iron fence around it. And as we're coming down this great staircase, I look as all these cars, and in Paris they're all, you know, shopping after work. I saw this place called Odiot, O-D-I-O-T, jeweler. And my Aunt Winnie had already been in the place and said they were very snooty and they didn't speak English and they locked the door and everything. I said, we're going over there. And I grabbed her by the hand. We were running across the street and I'm trying in my horrible French to decide what I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And we got over there and the lights, and I could see a guy in there. The lights were on. We went in. He had to unlock the door. And I started to tell him about this silver, and he said, I speak English.
Oh.
And he had a big cabinet of drawers of different patterns, and I recognized it right away.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Terrific.
And that was bought in 1865.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was split up. different people had, you know, so I gathered together a lot of it, yeah. So they had a good time. They had 18 people in their group. They traveled with their family and their friends, and they were gone for 6 months, and she had just had a baby before they left, and she had a wet nurse to take care of my grandfather while they were gone.
Wow.
Oh, and they sailed in a ship that I was fascinated with that had sails, but it also was the beginning of coal, and they couldn't store a lot of coal. But anyhow, they could use coal and they could use the sails.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Milton Egbert, like you say, he was a, like so many of those oil men in those days, not just him. Most of those oil men in those days were gamblers at heart. The industry was built by gambling.
Oh, yeah. And they took chances. Oh,
immense
yeah.
chances. And they won big, but they lost big, real big.
He died poor.
Yeah,
basically.
You've told me that.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's well known. Everybody associates that name with all that success up there on Oil Creek, but they don't realize what you've just told us.
He was in his office in Pittsburgh. They'd moved to Pittsburgh by then when they had a pile of money, and he died with a stroke with a whole lot of telegrams of dry holes.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. Is that right? Well, he used to go up to the Titusville Exchange. And in fact, I believe, I'm sure he was involved both in the Oil City Exchange, a founder, as well as the Titusville Exchange. He was a pretty active player up there in that Titusville Exchange, if I recall. Am I correct?
I don't know those facts.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can then tell you something about it. He was. There's plenty of written documentation of his involvement in that thing, and that's consistent with him, his way of life, and the way of life of all of those big oil.
Well, then they had another son, Great Uncle Victor, who I never saw, and I tried to find out what he ever did. He's buried up at Grove Hill. He my mother said he played cards. He rode his horse, and he graduated from Princeton.
And
then when his father died suddenly in Pittsburgh, this guy had to go to work.
Oh, wow.
And then he died young.
Yeah, well, work will do that to you, Pam.
MC's wife up here, Emma.
Mm-hmm.
Emma Taft Broward Egbert, and she lived in a boarding house. And where the parking lot is behind Grace Methodist Church, there was a big boarding house there.
Yeah. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
It's not well known, I guarantee you that. All right, look, just real quick, I realize Dr. Albert Egbert would have been a great
uncle.
Mm-hmm. But I think, why don't you, at least for the benefit of our broader audience in Pennsylvania, kind of give them some sense of what he did down there in Franklin?
Well, first he lived up in Halliday Run Road, and they played with Indians, and one of his children was named Seneca, and he became a doctor. He went to Penn.
Mm-hmm.
And they then moved to Franklin because there was a school in Franklin, a seminary, so he could have his daughters educated.
Oh.
That's why he moved to Franklin.
Why, yeah.
And he was quite a civic guy. He was in Congress, and he loved trees and parks. And after he died, it was his friends who took up a collection to have that fountain built.
Yes.
He didn't build it.
Right.
It was in honor of him.
Right. That's a memorial to him. They appreciated his, basically, his generosity and philanthropy to that community over the years that he was alive. He was involved in the Eclipse Refinery in the beginning. It changed hands and was eventually bought by Standard Oil. But he really, and I don't know if you know this, he really invested his oil money into coal mines, and I understand his coal mines did pretty well. So he continued to do reasonably well after his days up in Oil Creek.
And he had a pile of kids.
Yeah, right. And Thaddeus, the one who was the physician, where did he end up practicing? Do you know?
Around here.
Oh, is that right?
He married a nurse, Aunt Nan. I don't know what happened to her or anything about them. I mean, I never knew any of these people, but I certainly heard about them.
Did you ever hear how that family, that was a foreign family in Mercer County.
Right.
Where did they get the means and wherewithal to send those sons to medical school?
They sold bushels of corn and things
like
that.
Lots of corn. Okay.
Yeah, and of course there were trains, and they could go to Cleveland.
And we also forget in this day that physicians in those times, though they were esteemed in the community and considered learned men, it didn't necessarily mean
they didn't go to college very long to be a doctor.
No.
I mean, like maybe 2 years or something, but at least they went.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, let's now make the transition back to the 20th century and get back to the years your father was so, if you don't mind, your father was so involved in Quaker State. Your father's life with Quaker State also reflects the lives of so many other people around here in those times. You mentioned them all leaving. I don't know when they went down to D.C. on the train, but I imagine they were all going down to the train on Sunday night to get into Washington from Monday. Those were during the war years. What are some of your recollections about what life was like around here during World War II and what these men were doing?
Well, my father was a, what do you call him, air raid warden or something. They went out in your neighborhood. He had a big, long flashlight with red cellophane over it, and they wore a helmet. And they went out and told people if they had lights that weren't black, their lights weren't blacked out or something, I don't know. But it was a big deal to be an air raid warden. And then they had, of course, we bought those stamps at school, savings bond stamps or something. And he was away a lot. He traveled a lot. And, the Y Bridge up by Severely, it had armed guards up there. They had armed guards at the Rouseville refineries because it was making 100-octane aviation fuel.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
They had this area, Oil Well Supply, was working big time three shifts, and those machinists were exempt from the draft because it was so important.
That's right.
My friend Lois Folstead, her dad, he was drafted, and they said, no, we need him.
This area was strategically important to the war effort, and sometimes we kind of forget about that. Quaker State, I believe, was issued some of those E's.
Yes, the flag. They flew a flag that said E. Yeah.
Right.
And what was that for? I don't know.
Well, a particular achievement in the industrial activity supporting the war effort.
Okay.
I know that from my days in the Navy, because I was associated with a few of those efforts. Yeah, right, that was quite a thing. We forget that nowadays. We forget what these communities were doing. It was very different than after the war and before the war, when they were basically making product for the commercial market during those war years. And this was even before the Pearl Harbor. They were making a lot of lubricants for England and our allies, or would-be allies, or soon-to-be allies overseas. So all that was going on. Your dad was involved in that. I know that, very more so than most people realize. He eventually, like you say, he was the purchasing agent and involved in some interesting initiatives during that time that had to do with packaging and that sort of thing. I think he became an expert in packaging oil products.
Well, the reason that he had a leave of absence from Quaker State to work for the Marshall Plan,
yes.
And after they got all their money to get their industries going after the war, they didn't know how to package them.
Mm-hmm.
So he went over on a diplomatic passport with a Raymond Loewy industrial designer group, and they went, he made a lot of friends with that trip. And they were gone a long time. For example, they would have, seven men would be traveling with 72 suitcases or something,
mm-hmm.
full of toothpaste packaging and all the stuff that whatever they were making, I don't recall. But in any event, you may remember that some of the cities were divided and they rotated. They went into Trieste, or they went into different cities where maybe when they flew in, the airport was in the Russian zone.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't imagine why these men would have this much luggage, and they weren't going to let them take it in. And then they would say, okay, but it has to weigh the same when it comes in, when it goes out. But they wanted to give samples, but they would wait. And I mean, they had a schedule, but they would wait until maybe by then the Brits or the Americans had the zone where the airport was.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had... Your father had, and you had an opportunity to meet them. You had a lot of foreign visitors here in this home, and you entertained them and did wine and dine, and he conducted his business affairs with them right here in Oil City. This is an international community after the war. Am I correct?
That's right. We had the Mexican group was important to Quaker State because they nationalized the petroleum industry. It was a Pemex or something.
Sounds
And But they wanted Quaker State lubricants, and there was a family that was related to the president or something. Their name was Flores, and they were the ones that imported Quaker State for the whole country. My parents even went down to, a wedding, and then they told them that, they were going to Europe for their honeymoon, and they said they should go to Niagara Falls for their honeymoon. So they came back from Europe and came to our house, and we sent them up to Niagara Falls with a car and a driver.
Right.
Yeah. And they had a daughter, Patricia, who was a good friend of Blackie Cook's daughter, and she would come here, and they didn't want her to come here. They were afraid she'd be kidnapped or something, because they live in these compounds that have, walls around them with jagged glass and stuff on the top.
Right.
I mean, there's no middle class.
Even today, in places in Mexico, Brazil, places like that, you see the same thing. Yep. It's real. We talk about our wall communities. They're kind of... really nothing compared to what they
This Flores family, they would wait for somebody to die so some other relative could move in.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, very different world. But they were all here. They visited with you and your family, your father. Your father was a famous... Let's talk a little bit about some of his achievements when he became chief executive officer of Quaker State. Now, one in particular... I've mentioned this, Steve, but it really strikes me as memorable. We all know, those of us who are familiar with Oil City, all know that South Penn Oil was bought by Ulicki and the other Licky brother from Texas in 63, something of that nature. He took control of the Pennzoil company, and then, I believe it was in 64, they moved the headquarters of Pennzoil to Houston, Texas. We kept the refinery, but that was Pennzoil left. They've been gone now for four decades.
Hugh and Bill Lutke never really lived here.
No.
One of the wives lived in Pittsburgh because she didn't want to live here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then those same brothers, and I don't think this is generally remembered, those same brothers wanted to take control of Quaker State, correct? Let's talk a little bit about that. They didn't. They didn't succeed. Do you want to explain?
There were a lot of secretaries over there at Quaker State who were on the phone day and night to get people to mail in their proxies.
There you go.
At that time.
There you go.
And some of these, one of my friends who taught school, she had a pile of stuff on her desk and she hadn't gotten around to it. And, my dad said, "Hey, Nancy, why don't you vote your proxy?"
The Gettys, J. Paul Getty was involved in that. Somehow or other, he had something to say about this. And they did own, I think it was 8% of Quaker State. And what your father did as the president and chief executive is got the board to authorize an increase in stock. They basically doubled the amount of stock that was out there. It really wasn't a stock split, but the authorized issuance of stock, which somewhat... it didn't neutralize, but it diminished the impact of the Getty-owned, Lipke-owned stock in terms of their control in the organization. And your father doing it and getting the board to agree to do that and to change one of the voting rules. They couldn't vote as one of those groups. He got them to agree to do that between issuing the stock and getting to change that rule. And that's a big thing for a board.
They kept it here.
They kept it here, exactly. And people don't remember that. What people seem to remember now is Bloom came to town and he basically Baum came to town and he took this Quaker State out of Oil City in, what was that, 96 or something of that nature. But they would have gone earlier. They would have gone possibly three decades before that without your father's role that he played in defending what I would call Quaker State and the Oil City connection. You don't talk too much about that.
I wasn't living here then.
So you weren't aware you were at school at the time?
No, I was in Colorado for 10 years,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's memorable. That's a big event. And, of course, the other thing I know about your father was during his time, most people say that was the golden age of Quaker State. They were the number one premium oil company in the world. They were very profitable in the last half of the 1960s. They had huge market share in the United States and throughout the world. It was a very, very successful company. And your dad was...
Well, he didn't monkey around. I know he didn't want people hanging around coffee machines, and he wanted them to work. And they had some black and white problems with a couple of employees, and... he told the government, "We're in the business to make money. We're not here to make people like each other."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he got away with it.
He got away with it.
Because people filed complaints.
Well, that was tough. I happen to know, of course, some of those guys who did work. And he said, boy, Leaf Worker was a tough taskmaster, but he was as tough on himself as he was. He was a workaholic, I would say, from what I can gather.
Yeah.
All right. Let's transition again. You've been involved in these past years with trying to keep the pride and the knowledge of the legacy of the oil industry in this region alive. You've been involved in some of what I do and my wife does, the Oil 150 thing. You've been involved in our historical efforts,
yeah,
that sort of thing. Do you think we're succeeding? That's a rough question.
I think the town is just sad. It's sad. The schools are sad. The people are not trying. I don't know what they can do at this point.
Well, among other things, we can do what we're doing right here. We can record what has happened, and of course the other folks who are making these same things. But
I mean, hasn't the town diminished by half?
Yeah, it has. But in truth, Pam, so is most of the industrial Northeast.
Yeah, Rust Belt.
And these smaller industrial towns, Oil City was kind of blessed, I believe, and I've tried to tell folks here that. They were a small rural town that had all the big cosmopolitan features of a very successful big town. And up until, the oil well supply days, people around here all did pretty well.
What other town do you know of this size and this remoteness would Guy Lombardo just love to come back to time after time after time?
Yes.
I mean, that sort of thing was amazing.
Yeah.
That 100 Club, 100 men, I think it has 50 people now, 50 men.
Uh-huh. What was the 100 Club about? Tell us a little bit about it.
Oh, 100 men joined or organized a dance club, dinner dance club. And, there was just waiting lists to get in, and they had 3 or 4 formal dances every year, and they would book these big-time bands when they were between New York and Chicago, maybe even a midweek formal dance.
Mm-hmm.
But always at Christmas, that was the best one. Everyone was in their baubles and bangles. And then the people got so friendly with Guy Lombardo, he was in the summer at Long Island or someplace, and they all knew him. He knew everybody's name. Forey Koontz just was there to talk to him and go to see him and hear him there and wherever. And
yeah. Well, this community in those days, in its golden days, if you will, could attract those kinds of performers really big time. You hear this otherwise, people have to realize we were on a railroad route that would take people. It was a way of going to New York, was a way of going to Buffalo from Pittsburgh or Chicago.
I went on the train from here, or maybe from Erie to Albany to New York. That was a sleeper.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go on the somehow you went to New Jersey and you had to get across the river. What train was that?
I don't know. I can't tell you.
Passenger trains were... And then when I went to college, on the East Coast, we still rode the trains. It was get a gang of people and go the same place at the same time, and it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew you were going to get there, and you knew you didn't have to monkey with a car.
Mm-hmm. I remember, Pam, when I was going up to Marquette, Milwaukee, the trains were still running out of Pittsburgh to Chicago. And the college crowd would all go back after Christmas, after New Year's.
That was fun.
Yes, it was. It was a lot of fun. If you've never experienced it, it's a shame. Because I don't think you can do that anywhere today. I don't even think Amtrak would run that. Now, I can't help but I've got to bring this up. When we came in here, there's a picture right across the room over there. Is it you as a young cheerleader?
I don't know.
That one right beside...
Oh, no, that's my niece.
Oh, that's your niece. That's your niece. Okay, tell us a little bit about your niece.
Okay, I have a brother, Robin Lee R. Jr., and he has 2 children.
Uh-huh.
And he was in the Navy, and he liked Boston, and he was on the USS Boston.
Oh, yeah.
And he said to my dad, I'm going to work in Boston. And Dad said, no, you go to work for a company, and they'll tell you where to go.
Uh-huh.
He said, no, I want to live in Boston. Well, anyhow, he lives in Boston. We're South Shore, Hingham now. But those pictures that you saw are his two kids.
Ah, okay.
And the girl, Amy, is in a soccer thing, and the boy is skiing. And they are both now married, and they're happy.
Good.
They're all very happy, and they're all very successful.
Good.
Although I do call up my nephew, he's Lee 3, Robbie, and I say, do you still have a job? Because he's working in Boston for a brokerage house called Loomis Sales,
mm-hmm.
and he's a new, young, just got an MBA in this May, this mm-hmm. past May, so he and another guy are the low men on the totem pole.
Well, you have to start at the bottom.
Oh, I know, but this financial, you know, I don't worry about him, I do, but he said their company is old guard, you know, they didn't make crazy loans or anything.
All right, well, nonetheless, the imagery of now it's soccer, that sort of thing, but when I came here, I ran into some guys my age, a little bit older, and they would say, once in a while, truthfully, the subject of Pam Fortin would come up, and
uh-oh.
They'd go, I tried to get a date with her. You guys probably don't know this. I tried to get a date with her so bad.
Oh, come on.
Yes.
Come
I can
on.
Think of one guy in Franklin particularly. You know him, but I won't mention his name. He said, I tried so bad, she wouldn't even look at me. And what people have to realize is, of course, you were very attractive. And you had these cars. They say, boy, she had some nice cars for a high school girl.
I never had a car.
Yeah, that's what they told me. That's what
my father said, nobody ever bought me a car. I'm not buying anybody a car.
Well, I was told you had this beautiful car, but I guess I'm wrong.
Oh, I had a car. In fact, I went last Saturday down to Pittsburgh with my theater group to see Jersey Boys.
Okay.
You're Just Too Good to Be True. You know those songs. And I said, I don't know when they were singing. I was been living in the mountains in Colorado and didn't go anywhere to read a paper or anything. And then when they came out with that song, I said, that's 66 or 65 because I had a Mustang convertible and we played that all the time.
All right. So
that song.
There's truth to these stories, Pat.
Well, just the wrong era. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Well.
Anyhow, it's a good show.
Yes. Well, I think we were kind of wrapping this up. Is there anything else you would like us to share with the people who are going to see this? You must realize they're going to be seeing, hopefully, over the next several decades. Hopefully, the end of time. This is certainly going to outlive you and I.
Well, I wish more of my family were around to talk and remember. And we do have big family reunions. We haven't lately. Actually, there was a Tonkin one this past June, but I was in on a house at the beach, and I paid and whatever. But in any event, I'll do it again. And but I wish that some of them were around, because some of them, especially my mother's cousin Buddy Tonkin from Clarksburg, he's the one that has the swords and all the stuff, and he stood up at one reunion, and his father wasn't there, and Buddy had been a bombardier in World War II out of England and did many more missions than he was supposed to have done. And when the war was over, he was just beat up. He'd never got shot down, but he had to go to a sanitarium place in Switzerland or something. And he was really a hero. And then he also talked about Captain John Tonkin. He knows all about him.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish, you know, sometime I could get him up here. Oh, one time, Buddy and his son John and John's son called up, and they said, we want to come up from Clarksburg, and we want to put Confederate flags on the Tonkin graves,
mm-hmm.
which we did.
Whoa, is that right?
I called up Wilcox and told him to fix up that grave.
They keep coming.
I don't, you know, I used to kind of kid my Grandma Egbert, and I told her, you know, I'd call it the Civil War, and she'd say, that's a war between the states.
Right. I still have friends from the South, old Southern families, and you're right, that is how they refer to it.
Well, when I went this past summer down there to Myrtle Beach, I saw this thing about a rice plantation, and I was by myself, and I decided I'd go in there because I'd heard that my great-grandfather had named his kids after some of these Southern people, and one was this Lorraine Lombard and this Wade Hampton. They were big South Carolina, and then I found out those weren't their places, but at Columbia, South Carolina, is where all this Wade Hampton. I'm going to go there sometime and find out if he named his kids after these people that were Civil War generals or whatever they were.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I'd like to know about them.
Sure he would. Sure he would. One other thing before we kind of cut off here is your father, apart from his Quaker State involvement, his career with Quaker State, he was also known as a great fisher. Oh, and see the smile. I'm glad I remembered this. It was. Our friend Ron Black mentions him quite a bit. Ron's a fisherman, as you know.
And he got Johnny Comet into fishing.
And Johnny Comet,
yep.
Exactly. John Comet, who we've interviewed Johnny.
Yep.
I have to tell you that. These men were world-class trout fishermen, primarily,
yeah.
Weren't they?
Oh, yeah.
And they would take these trips up into somewhere around, up in the northern tier
Potter
of Pennsylvania.
County,
yes,
and
exactly.
Elk, yeah.
Right.
And then down by Penn State, there's one of those catch-and-release places that Jimmy Carter used to go to. They went there because Johnny Comet has a daughter down there.
Yeah.
No, my dad was, if the other companies wanted to entertain him, like Amoco in Chicago, they were so happy because a couple of their top guys that we liked, they'd come in on one of those planes that could hardly land at Franklin because the runway wasn't long enough,
mm-hmm.
and go out and do the Snake River and the Green River and big time.
Yeah.
Big time.
Yeah.
And up to Alaska, it was taken there. That's how they entertained him.
They lived pretty well in that respect.
And I was trying to get a hold of a couple of those Amoco guys for that Oil 150 thing.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Again, for the information of our audience, Amoco was a big distributor of Quaker State products.
They sold Quaker State in every gas station in all their states. Mm-hmm. They had gas stations. And I still have an Amoco credit card because of that.
Do you really?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's BP, you know. But
yeah.
Hard to know who's was what.
Who owns what nowadays? Mm. Exactly.
No, he went as a little kid fishing with his dad, and his dad did not have a car, and they would hire a cab or they'd go in horse and buggy to the streams.
Is that right?
And his two brothers, they were all big time fishermen,
mm-hmm.
and Dad liked so much going with Johnny Comet because knowing so much about geology. He keeps a daily journal, and then he'd give my dad copies,
mm-hmm.
of where all they'd been and the rock formations and all of that.
Yeah, John Comet made a comment in his interview for this program to the effect that John, as you know, was a trained geologist out of Penn State.
I thought that. He wasn't. He was an oil and gas petroleum engineer.
That's right. Oil and gas petroleum engineer. That's right. But because John was associated with a gas company, geology was a keen interest of his, and he made the comment in his interview with us that he thought your father knew more about geology than he did, even though John was an oil and gas engineer, and one of the most knowledgeable geologists, even though he didn't really have a background, a formal trained background in geology, he just trained himself. I don't know if John ever made that comment to you, but he certainly made that to us. And then John then said, it's probably because he went to Cornell, which is one of the best schools in the country for geology. So,
well, they had a lot of... Dad really was a happy Cornellian, and my brother went there, and maybe he shouldn't have, I don't know, but he ended up as class president, not when he was an undergrad, but for reunions and everything for... Mm-hmm. 100 years, he was on the phone. His secretaries must have been working a lot for Cornell.
Yeah. Well, Pam, we're coming to an end here. I want to thank you again for having us in your home. It's a wonderful home.
Thank you.
I also want to thank you for how good you've been to those of us who have an interest in the oil history and the oil legacy of not just Oil City, but the expanded oil region. And how you've lent your goodwill, which is very important.
Thank you.
Lent your goodwill to our efforts. And believe me, you know I appreciate it. And I want to thank you very much for all of that.
Well, I want the future generations to know something. Something. I know when I've taught social studies, before I went to China, I taught for a semester at a Cranberry. you know, they hadn't been to the Drake Well, and they didn't know this, and they didn't know that. And one kid I was tutoring, I could do whatever I wanted to with him, and I said to the principal out there, I said, I'm taking this kid to these museums. Is that all right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, and he was happy.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to read a book. He wanted to go see.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's what it takes.
Yep.
That's what it takes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Oh.
How much time did we put into that?
Oh, about 57 minutes.
Oh, good.
Pretty close.
Good job.
Constructive criticism.
Oh. Yeah. No, it was a nice conversation.
Very nice. Yeah,